Good morning. The Education Quality Subcommittee will now come to order. For the record, please remember to turn on your microphones for roll call. Misty, please call the roll.
Chair Trabolsi?
Here.
Vice Chair Temple?
Here.
Ranking Member Benjamin?
Present.
Representative Alvarez? Representative Beltran is excused. Representative Kennedy?
Here.
Representative Casello?
Here.
Representative Chamberlain?
Here.
Representative Daniels is excused. Representative Franklin?
Present.
Representative Gant?
Here.
Representative Garcia?
Present.
Representative Gilibardo? Representative Gonzalez-Pittman?
Present.
Representative Plasencia is excused. Representative Tomko? Here. Representative Yeager?
Here.
Let the record show that a quorum is present. And good morning, members. It's great to be with you again. Before we begin, I'd like to ask all members and the audience to silence all electronic devices. And I'm so honored to be able to still serve you as your chair alongside our new vice chair, Temple, and our Democratic ranking member, Representative. So good to see you. We do have three new members that have joined our committee this year, Vice Chair Temple, Representative Plasencia, who's not here today, and newly elected Representative Chamberlain. So I'd like to personally welcome you to our Education Quality Subcommittee. We're happy to have you with us. And Vice Chair Temple and Representative Chamberlain, if you could just introduce yourselves and say a few words, we'd love to hear from you.
Well, thank you so much. I look forward to serving with this entire team. My background is in K-12 education. I've been a teacher, principal, worked at the county office. Currently, I work at Lake Sumter State College as dean or a workforce AVP. I'm passionate about education. That's what I chose to do with my life and be a part of. And so I'm just looking forward to being a part of this team and looking forward to the great things that we're going to do this year. So thank you.
Hello, everyone. I'm Representative Chamberlain from District 24, which is North Central Florida, known as Horse Country. I don't have the background in education, but I did go to school, and I'm very excited to be here. I've had the privilege with my beautiful wife of raising four now adult children, and education has been our passion really their whole lives, as well as early it was instilled by our parents as well. So we're very excited to be on this committee, and thank you for allowing us to be here and learn from everybody that's here. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I'd also like to welcome, we have some students here from the University of St. Augustine and FAMU, so welcome to Education Quality Subcommittee. We're happy to have you. It's going to be a great presentation today. I hope you find it a meaningful use of your time. Before we start, today you know that we're going to have a presentation regarding Marjory Stoneman Douglas Act and look back through some history and look forward into some ways that we are going to continue to honor the legacy of the people that we lost on February 14th, 2018. I had the privilege to tour Marjory Stoneman Douglas twice this summer, and it was incredibly impactful, and it just solidified all the hard work that people have been doing inside and outside of this chamber to make sure that when we send our children to school, that we have an obligation that they return home safe. So with that, at this time, I'd like to invite to the podium the Department of Education Senior Chancellor, Adam Miller, to provide our first presentation on school safety. Chancellor Miller, thank you for being here today. This is a heavy topic. We're pleased that you're with us. And members, we're going to hear both presentations back to back before we ask any questions, because there may be some slight overlapping in material, and I want to make sure that you get a full overview before we ask these questions. So thank you. You're recognized.
Members, my name is Adam Miller, Senior Chancellor at the Department of Education, and I am honored to be here today to present this information to you. My presentation is going to focus on kind of the changing landscape as it relates to school safety policy landscape in Florida since the tragedy at MSD in 2018. The first slide here just is a graphic that shows you the primary or the major pieces of legislation and other policy changes that have occurred over those years. And I will go into each one of those, give some primary or some of the primary components of each bill, and then also talk about the Office of Safe Schools, what we do at the Department of Education. So I'll start with in 2018. As we all know, tragedy at MSD in February of 2018 was right in the middle of legislative session. The legislature acted incredibly quickly in the aftermath of that attack on MSD and passed Senate Bill 7026. There were a number of dramatic improvements made to school safety approach and policy in that bill. I'll go through some of these. They're all up on the slide for you. So there was the creation of the Guardian Grant Program, which provided funding to sheriffs to screen and train guardians in our schools. And it also authorized the sheriffs to establish that program. The Department of Education worked closely with the Attorney General's Office and the FDLE on selecting a vendor to create the mobile suspicious activity reporting tool, which is known as Fortify Florida, and that is still available and used widely across our state. The creation that bill also created or established the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School Public Safety Commission, which you will hear from the chair, Sheriff Galtieri, here briefly about that commission and its work. And our office continues to provide support to that commission as they carry on their important work. The department also works really closely as part of when this bill was first established or this law was first passed to require districts to designate a school safety specialist within each district. The bill also included some additional requirements around mental health training and services for students and training for staff. And then there was a requirement that every public school in the state have a safe school officer on campus all day, somebody that would be there to respond immediately in the event of another active assailant type situation. And there was also some funding associated with mental health services and supports. So that initial legislation included $70 million for the mental health assistance allocation. Each year that appropriation has increased. This most recent year in the 2023-24 GAA was $160 million for the mental health assistance allocation. Each district has to create, develop, and implement a plan under those funds or within to use those funds. The plans have to be focused on this multi-tiered system of support for students to deliver evidence-based mental health care assessment. Districts use those dollars for school-based services. They also are required to have contracts with community providers as well so that students can be referred. So if there are students with more intensive needs that can't be supported through the school-based services, then they make referrals to those community-based services. The other thing that initial bill did was the creation of the Office of Safe Schools within the Department of Education. We have four major functions, and I'll talk a little more about these or go into a little more detail later in the presentation, but you can see that the major functions of this office are compliance and monitoring. We do a fair amount of data and analytics. We administer a number of grants and contracts, and we do a fair amount of training, which is ramped up, and I'll talk again a little bit more as we get near the end of my part of the presentation. In 2019, the next year, there was passage of bill, Senate Bill 7030. And again, the legislature and the governor continued to focus on school safety and continued to refine and strengthen our policy landscape. This bill required the department to develop a standardized behavioral threat assessment instrument. The department at that time researched and ultimately adopted the Virginia's Comprehensive School Threat Assessment Guidelines, or CSTAG, which is the threat assessment process that we've been using since then and will continue to use up until December 31st of this year. And I believe Sheriff Galtieri is going to speak more deeply about the transition away from that process to the now Florida-specific model that has been developed. The other changes within that bill included some requirements for districts to promote the use of Fortify Florida, which was the mobile suspicious reporting tool, some additional requirements or authorities for the Commissioner of Education to oversee compliance with safe schools rules and statutes. There was explicit language that made clear that charter schools also must comply with all of the school safety statutes, had some transfer student records, and then some additional clarifications within that bill. Additionally, in 2019, there was an executive order issued by Governor DeSantis, which included a number of requirements. The department completed an audit and review of school-based discipline diversion programs used across Florida school districts. We cooperated or worked very closely with the Department of Juvenile Justice to create that report, and that was submitted to the MSD Commission in August of 2019. We also extended the grant application period for the Guardian program to try to continue to provide flexibility for school districts and sheriffs to make sure that we could ensure that any district that wanted to take advantage of the Guardian program was able to do that. The Office of Safe Schools developed some best practices around school hardening and harm mitigation, and that was delivered to the governor and the legislature in 2019. There are some additional clarifications around the requirements for a safe school officer. And then there was also an extension to a requirement to develop an integrated data repository, which is the Florida School Safety Portal, which allows threat assessment teams to really access timely information when they're evaluating a potential threat. It includes information from DCF, from DJJ, local law enforcement, as well as social media and CSER data as well. In 2020, House Bill or Senate Bill 70, which was known as Alyssa's Alert, was passed. And this, in recognition, memory, and in honor of Alyssa Aladaf, who tragically lost her life at MSD, this law requires every public school in the state to implement a mobile panic alert system and required that those systems have real-time coordination between multiple first responder agencies. Our division of Safe Schools, or Office of Safe Schools, currently manages those contracts. We have 8 vendors right now who provide those services to school districts and charter schools around the state. In 2021, Senate Bill 590, much of this legislation really focused on oversight and compliance and aligning resources to better address student mental health issues. Our Bureau of Exceptional Student Education and Student Services really takes the lead on the programmatic side of this. There were some enhanced requirements around the involuntary examination, the Baker Act laws requiring parental notification, some additional de-escalation training for safe schools officers as well, and really ensuring that parents were notified timely if there was an issue of an involuntary examination. There is also a requirement in there that if school districts issued student ID cards to students in grades 6 through 12, that there was information on those cards around a suicide hotline contact information. The department also initiated some additional rulemaking that year with one of our safe schools rules, the school safety requirement and monitoring. This rule was effective in July 21. We've amended it a number of times, and it really lays out in detail some of the school district responsibilities around school safety, including emergency drills, the timing of those drills, what needs to be included after action reports, and also the procedures and criteria that our school or our Office of Safe Schools use to monitor schools and districts for compliance. In 2022, we saw the passage of House Bill 1421. This bill granted the Commissioner of Education additional enforcement authority as it relates to school safety and security, and also required the Office of Safe Schools to intensify its field compliance efforts. It extended the MSD Commission through 2026. It also required the department to develop a model family reunification plan, which the department created, posted on the website, and districts can then use that to develop their own local reunification plans. It also required that certain law enforcement officers are present when there are active assailant drills at the school, ensuring that they are part of that drill because they will be first responders in the event that that happens. And there were also some additional requirements related to compliance, and also required that at least 80% of school personnel receive the youth mental health awareness and assistance training. So that is basically all staff within schools. 80% of them have to, at least 80% have to receive that training. Also in this year was the final report of the 20th statewide grand jury. This was a statewide grand jury that was convened to look at MSD, what happened, what could have been done differently, and what can we do to help ensure that Florida has the safest schools in the country. There were a number of interim reports also, 2019, 2020, and the legislature actually used those reports and those findings to help drive some of the policy that we've already discussed. But the final report was released in 2022. It did include some findings around underreporting, data underreporting, as it relates to what's called SESR, the School Environmental Safety Incident Reporting, which will lead to some additional changes in legislation that we'll talk about in a moment. It identified a number of significant problems with the PROMISE program in Broward, which was their diversion program. As a result of this EO, the executive order, the Office of Safe Schools began investigating those findings, did a number of visits, site visits around the state for schools that were identified and districts that were identified. We met with superintendents, we met with stakeholders, and really tried to make sure that we were implementing the recommendations within that executive order. And then this past legislation, in 2023, the passage of House Bill 543, there were a number of significant school safety enhancements that were included in this bill. One of them, which again Sheriff Galtieri will speak more deeply about, is the requirement to move to a statewide behavioral threat management operational process and really a Florida-specific model. But some additional changes in that bill would allow private schools to participate in the Guardian program. It required every law enforcement agency around the state to have an active assailant response policy. For the first time, it required that when a school-based threat management team meets to evaluate whether a student is a threat, that team includes somebody that actually knows the student, that has personal knowledge of the student. While that may have been happening and was happening in a lot of schools, it was never a requirement. It's now an explicit requirement, and that's going to be really important. And I think, again, Sheriff Galtieri will speak to that more deeply. It also required, and this was in response to some of the findings in the grand jury report, that the department identify which of those safety incidents had to be reported to law enforcement. And so the department, through rulemaking, identified 22 of the 26 identified safety incidents that are tracked now have to be reported to law enforcement on the campus. And the bill also create the Florida Safe Schools Canine Program, which will allow the community to make donations to local law enforcement to help purchase or care or train for ammunition, firearm detection canines that can be used on our K-12 campuses. So going back to the creation of the Office of Safe Schools and what our primary responsibility is, or that division's primary responsibility is, a big part of what we do is compliance. We ensure that our school districts and our charter schools and all of our public schools are compliant with the provisions of the law. One of those is that every public school has to have a safe school officer on campus from bell to bell, at least one. So we do monitoring visits throughout the year to ensure that our schools are meeting this requirement or complying with this requirement. I believe we'll go to it. This here is just, this is a screenshot of a dashboard that we use to track
progress you'll see in the upper left there. In the first 2.5 weeks of school this year, we visited 520 schools to ensure that they had a safe school officer on campus. And very happy to report that it was 100% compliant. So every single school that our team visited during those first 2.5 weeks had a safe school officer when we showed up on campus. Additional compliance-related activities relate to Alyssa's Alert testing. Again, Alyssa's Alert is the mobile panic system. And so when we are doing our monitoring visits throughout the state, we are ensuring that schools are testing that system, making sure that there is real-time coordination with the 911 center, and ensure that folks understand how to use that system so that in the event that there is an active assailant or other some other type of emergency that requires immediate first response, that they can access that system and get immediately connected with the 911 center. I talked about this a little bit, really. This is overall our compliance. Again, we have a team of compliance officers that are out and about around the state. They're regionally located throughout the state so that we can visit schools across the state regularly. We do a number of different types of visits. We will do, as I said earlier, the school safety officer, safe school officer check, where we will just show up. We'll be there for 30 minutes. We make sure there's a safe school officer there, and we're gone. We also do more in-depth, where we will show up unannounced, and we will do several hours where we're looking at our doors locked. Are they checking badges when folks come in? We're going through, we have an entire rubric that I'm not going to go into great detail right now, but we have an entire rubric that our team will go through and check and make sure that this school is implementing all the requirements and that it is they are informed and know how to follow those statutes and rules. And then we follow up with any findings and ensure that they make those corrections. This, I already showed you a little bit, but this is, again, the dashboard. You'll see that the top on the left there is the safe school officer checks. And then down the bottom, you'll see that we've also done 128 full monitoring visits so far this school year. And so that will number will dramatically increase throughout the year as our team is out and monitoring schools. We also administer the Florida Safe School Assessment Tool. And this is an online tool that school districts use where they provide information. They do assessments of every school building in the district. All public schools, including charter schools, complete this each year. We also use this information to review the school hardening grant applications for schools. And then I want to talk a little bit about our training efforts. And again, Sheriff is going to talk a little bit more about this transition from the CSTAG model of threat assessment to our new threat monitoring or threat monitoring approach. So we do a number of trainings around the state. We do training on the SESR, which is the School Environmental Safety Incident Reporting System. We administer the grant for the Guardian training. But this transition from the CSTAG to the Florida model is really significant. So we have over 20,000 employees that we have to train between the beginning of the school year, which started in August, through December 31st. It's about 22,000 people we've identified. Each one of those people, it's all the threat management team members, every school-based threat management team member, has to go through an in-person 8-hour training within the next couple of months. So in order to do that, we worked really closely with the sheriff. We worked really closely with the commission. We developed these trainings. We then employed a train-the-trainer model where we developed a 3-day training that we could certify district staff to be trainers. We have certified 186 district staff who are now doing trainings locally across the state. And we are also continuing to do that training as well. So with the end goal of ensuring that all 22,000 of those school threat-based team members are trained by December 31st, so that on January 1st, we are fully prepared and ready to transition to the Florida model for threat management. I believe that is my last slide.
Thank you so much for your presentation, Chancellor Miller. Thanks for sticking around, too. We appreciate that. For our next presentation, I would like to welcome to the podium Sheriff Bob Galtieri, who we fondly call Sheriff Bob. Sheriff Galtieri has been the Pinellas County Sheriff since 2011 and has served as the chair of the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Commission since its inception. Sheriff, thank you so much for being here today. I know your schedule's busy. We appreciate your time.
Glad to be here, Madam Chair, committee members. It's a pleasure to be here with you today. As the chair mentioned, I'm Bob Galtieri. I'm the sheriff in Pinellas County. And for the last 5.5 years, I've had the honor and the privilege of chairing the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Commission. And when I got that call from then Governor Rick Scott in March of 2019 and asked me to undertake this, I had no idea the magnitude of the undertaking, but it's been an absolute privilege to do it because the schools in Florida today are safer than they were in 2018. The first slide that we have up there, and, you know, there's cliches in this world, and I guess that could be one of never forget, but it's more than a cliche. It's what drives us and is so important that we don't ever forget those 17 people that were killed on February 14th, 2018, in Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, and that there were 34 people shot and or killed in 3 minutes and 51 seconds that day. This past weekend, in the chair, and some of you were there, as that building is getting ready to be taken down, there were about 235 people from 25 states, including here in Florida, that were invited to, to tour and do a guided tour of that building. That building is in the same condition it was on February 14th. And sorry to be graphic about it, but the kids' blood still on the floor. The Dunkin' Donuts box from February 14th on Valentine's Day is still sitting on the floor. The work that they were working on at their desks is still sitting there, and it's preserved as it was that day. That was my sixth time being in that building, and it doesn't get any easier being in there. And for all of those family members, their lives don't get any easier, and they are truly forever changed. And it really is what drives us to make sure that we're doing better today than we were in 2018, because I'll tell you, and it's just the reality of it is that Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, Broward County School District, and the state of Florida was not prepared in 2018. We were not where we needed to be. And it's against the backdrop of, and I say this as a rhetorical question, obviously, is that what year did Columbine happen? It happened in 1999. So why in 2018, 19 years later, did the Broward County School District, the second largest school district in the state of Florida, the sixth largest in the United States, not have an active assailant response policy for the district? Why had they not done any drills on that campus for the last year? Why were there not any safe areas or hard corners marked? And why was the threat management or threat assessment protocols of the district never trained on? And the assistant principal who was tasked with doing the threat assessment of that killer botched it, and it sat on his desk for months. So we have to ask those questions as to why, because, and the reason is because people think that this doesn't happen to me. This doesn't happen here. This doesn't happen in my backyard. It doesn't happen in communities like Parkland, Florida, that 2 days before the incident were named the safest city in the state of Florida by the Chamber of Commerce. The reality is, and if you're honest about it with yourself and intellectually honest about it itself, is you have to accept the premise. And we don't like it, and it's a hard thing to say, but it is going to happen again. It's gonna. History tells us that. The question is when and where, but the ultimate question is, what are we doing differently today to drive a different outcome than what we were doing previously? That's the real question. And we have to be honest about that, and so we have to be prepared. And as the chair said, and it really rings true, is that we all that have any responsibility have to meet the expectations of parents. And the expectation is, when you send your kid to school in the morning, the kid's coming home safe in the afternoon. And it is the number one priority. It has to be the number one priority. It just required a culture change to get there. But I think we're there, and we continue to get there with others, is the realization that this is the number one priority. And sometimes I hear from people, and I spent a lot of time in 2019 and early 2020 before COVID traveling the country and traveling the state and presenting on this to educators, to schools, to everybody that would listen. And I hear from people sometimes, it's not my job, it's not my responsibility. Yes, it is, it's everybody's. And in for the teachers, for the administrators, for the people, because we have to meet the expectation of those parents. So it is everybody's responsibility. It is the number one thing. And you can't do anything else in education if everybody's not safe. And that's just the place we have to be, and that's the premise we have to operate from. So when we talk about this issue of being as safe as we possibly can and how do you respond to these occurrences, there's really four things that come into play. The first is to do what we all want, what we all strive for, and we will never achieve totally. You can achieve to some degree, but we'll never achieve total prevention because it's going to happen again. The question is when and where. But when we talk about prevention, that's what we all want, and this is what I'm going to focus on here in a second, we're going to focus on here today, is the greatest opportunity of prevention, and that's threat management. The next thing is mitigation. Mitigation is site hardening, drills, those things that are going to mitigate the harm, because at Stoneman Douglas, 3 minutes and 51 seconds, 34 people shot and or killed. That's way too many. One's too many, but one's better than 34. It didn't. Why do we get 34? Because they were totally unprepared. That killer got out of the Uber on Pine Island Road, walked through an unlocked gate, was seen by somebody. They didn't have any communication devices, couldn't alert others. Doors were locked. Others were unlocked. They're just totally unprepared. So why was there such tragedy there? Why was it of the magnitude? Because there was no mitigation. There was nothing in place to mitigate the harm. The third thing is response, and that's simply just law enforcement or a guardian or somebody there to stop the killing. And the fourth, which is as equally important as anything else, and ask the parents where it didn't happen appropriately at Parkland, is reunification and taking care of the survivors and the recovery aspect. So what we want is 2, 3, and 4 to be the insurance policy that you hope you never need. We don't want to ever use mitigation, response, and recovery. We want to be successful at prevention, and we want to stop this and make every effort to stop it. And the other thing I'll say about all of this is there is no finish line. There's no completion point. There's no end zone. You know, people have asked me at times, you know, when's the commission work end? It doesn't ever end. When does this ever stop? It doesn't stop. And it shouldn't stop. Why did we not start in 1999 after Columbine? Why did it take Parkland? And this body, this legislature and the governor did yeoman's work in 2018. In 30 days, you all passed a 105-page bill that drastically changed the landscape and did it fast and did it right, and it was a great bill. But it's 19 years later. Why were we not prepared? So we've got to keep our eye on this, and we've got to keep it moving. So when we talk about threat management, and I'm going to talk a little bit more in detail about it, where we are today. But what threat management is to identify concerning behavior and do something about it before it manifests at a higher level and before it becomes a threat. So in the basics of it are, is that you have individuals, they have a baseline behavior. When people exhibit concerning behavior, and we'll talk more about this, is that we intervene so that we can prevent them from moving down the pathway to violence. So these are all concepts that are part of threat management. Concerning behavior, a pathway to violence. These are all terms of art within threat management. But the real key is, first of all, is that we have things in place where people see something that's happening right now that's really bad, and they can do something about it. Because then if you have to engage the mitigation or response, you can. Is there imminent danger, and do people know to report it? Assuming that it's not imminent danger, then the next steps, because there is that concerning behavior, is to look at it, to investigate it, to analyze it, and importantly, to do something about it and to manage it. So in the case of the shooter at Stoneman Douglas, and I've been doing this for a long time. I started my law enforcement career 42 years ago, so I've been around for a bit. And I can tell you, in that amount of time, I've never seen anybody that received as much in the area of mental health services, counseling, treatment, you name it, that this guy received, whether it was school-based, community-based, private, across the board. And the amount of law enforcement activity, the amount of information that people had, and you know when it all came together and we all knew, and again, that's one of those rhetorical questions, you know when we all knew? When the commission started unraveling it and peeling it back, and we had this, oh my God, look at all this stuff. It's all there, but the dots weren't connected. There's nobody, it was all siloed. Because nobody's putting it together to look at the big picture and say, huh, we got a problem. Let's do something about it collectively. No, you got this, and you got this, and you got this, and you got this, and nobody talks, and it's all siloed. And that's what happened with him. It was there. And the sad part is that I would never go far as far to say never go as far to say that it could have been prevented, but the harm could have been mitigated, but it wasn't connected. As I said, this is the greatest opportunity to prevent. That's what we hear people talk about all the time. They want to prevent. Well, this is the greatest way to prevent it, and threat management is harm prevention. You'll hear people when they talk about this sometimes use the terms interchangeably of threat assessment and threat management. And in the original statute in Florida in 7026 that Chancellor talked about is that they use the term threat assessment. There's a big difference between threat assessment and threat management. Threat assessment is a component of what you really want to do, and that is threat management. They're really not the same. And when we talk about this, we're trying to, at the earliest possible stage, identify those concerning behaviors, and we don't want them to become threats. If it's already become a threat, it's gone too far. We've got a problem, so we want to identify it early on. And what concerning behavior really is sometimes nuanced activity that is a deviation from baseline behavior. And so in order to flesh this out further, and concerning behavior can generally, or on its own, or individually, be innocuous behavior. It could be somebody that just isn't socializing the way they used to. It could be somebody that isn't doing well in school. Grades are slipping. It could be a whole combination of things where any one of those things by themselves isn't necessarily a problem, but you put it together with something that's causing it, and now you've got something that could be of concern. And concerning behavior is not necessarily prohibited behavior. If it's reached a level of it's a threat, it's probably prohibited. It's probably something that's against policy, against law. It's something that's reached a higher level. So it's not necessarily prohibited. But concerning behavior is what we're trying to look at and nip it before it manifests as a threat. Now, when you look at the school shootings, you look at active assailant incidents, you look at mass casualties, intentional mass casualty events around the country in the last number of decades, there's very few things in this world we can say always about, but this is one of those you can pretty much say always about, is that it's based on a grievance. It's based on whoever engaged in this activity of being ticked off, about being mad, about being upset, about feeling slighted. They have a grievance about something, whether it's a kid in school who got a bad grade, doesn't like a teacher, didn't get on the football team, parents have done something to them, they were bullied. Something has got them to a place where they have a grievance about something. And what happens with these people, with their grievances that manifest initially, usually with these concerning behaviors, is that they don't have the coping mechanisms. Is that we all have issues in life and things that make us upset. Thankfully, the majority of people have ways of dealing with it that don't result in violence. But these people don't have the coping mechanisms. And so when they don't have the coping mechanism, they don't know how to do it, what they resort to is taking it out on somebody else. So I'm just including this here. I'm not going to read them to you, but these are examples of concerning behaviors. And you can see here that most of these things are not prohibited behaviors. Is that social distancing, out of context outbursts, agitation, in and of themselves are not necessarily prohibited. Some of them could be, depends upon how it's done, but most of them are not exactly prohibited behaviors. But what, again, is really important, and that's why I've got to highlight it up here, is that all this has to be viewed against the backdrop of baseline behavior. If you have a kid that's exhibiting every single one of these things, but they've exhibited every single one of these things for the last 10 years, and that's the norm for that kid, then it's less problematic. So what you're looking for is concerning behaviors that have come on suddenly or over a short period of time that are caused by something that's giving them some angst, and they've got a grievance, and this is the way it's manifesting. So it all has to be balanced against the baseline to know whether you have a problem. Because any one of these things, again, doesn't necessarily mean there is a problem, but we start seeing it and somebody knows the kid, then we need to start looking at it to analyze it and make a decision. So this is what I basically talked about here about coping mechanisms and them when they can't getting on the pathway to violence. So the pathway to violence we're going to talk about here is a term of art. The pathway to violence is not linear. And what the pathway to violence is again, beginning with the personal grievance. So something's got them upset. is that it then goes to, what am I going to do about it? How am I going to act? I don't like this. So it goes to ideation. And the ideation is in the form of harm towards others. And then they start doing something more than just thinking about it. They start figuring it out. That's when they get on the internet and they start researching guns and they start researching other killers and they start figuring out, I'm going to take it out in this way. So it's some sort of research and planning. Now, when nobody's intervened and you've seen these concerning behaviors and you know it's based on something, now we start getting more of a problem because now they're starting to prepare to do something. It may actually be going out and getting a gun, getting a weapon, something that's a higher level, and then they start actually acting on it. Maybe they're going out and doing surveillance, they're casing, they're trying to figure out the best way in, probing and breaching, and then if nothing happens, it ends up in the attack itself. So this is the pathway to violence. It is linear. You could have somebody that begins with a personal grievance and goes right to attack. You can have somebody that sits a personal grievance for a day, a week, a month, months. Ideation takes a long time, and all of a sudden, it goes right to attack. Or it could have every one of these steps along the way. It's not linear. People jump on and off at different places. But what we want to do is catch it as soon as we possibly can, and then do something about it to get the people help so they have the right coping mechanisms and it never manifests as to a threat. Generally speaking, those things that are on the left are where you start seeing the concerning behaviors. Once it gets past and they're preparing, then there's usually some threats that manifest and it becomes more easily recognizable that there's a problem. So, as the Chancellor said, in 2019, the legislature required, because we don't have any consistency with the teams, that Florida adopt some sort of a, as they call these, threat assessment instruments. So when you hear the term threat assessment instrument, there is no instrument. It's the term that's used. And it's really a compilation of forms. When you talk about a threat assessment instrument, it connotes that we have a form, we've got a score or a checklist, and we can kind of add it all up, and it's given us some outcome. That's not what it is. It's a compilation of forms that help you acquire information so you can do an objective assessment. And that's so in 2019, Florida adopted the CSTAG model, got us in the right direction. We started looking at it, and the commission started looking at it really heavily in 2022 and realized that we got a problem. Is that we saw significant underutilization in some places. And I'm not throwing them under the bus. I've had the discussion with the superintendent down there in the past and Miami-Dade, and they fixed it, and they're fixing it now with this new model. Miami-Dade, largest district, 350,000 students, 500 schools, and in one school year in the entire district, they did like 8 threat assessments. They had no automated system. People weren't trained. They weren't using it. You take another school, Madison, with 2,000 students, and they did like 70. So it was underutilized, overutilized, wrong people in the wrong buckets. They had people going into threat management that shouldn't be in threat management, people not going in that should. The data showed we got a problem. So the commission looked at this extensively, brought it to leadership in the legislature, talked to the commissioner about it, and we decided it's time for a Florida model. Is that what we had adopted really isn't working well for us, and we need a Florida model. So this year you all passed a requirement that Florida adopt its own model. The State Board of Education adopted more specifics of it in August, and we are now with a Florida manual and a Florida instrument poised to implement the Florida model on January 1st of 2024. It's a huge undertaking. It's been a year in the works. But it is going to make a difference. I know it's going to make a difference, and we're going to be better off for it. And Florida schools are going to be safer for it, and we're going to do a better job of early on identifying these behaviors, getting the right people that need to be in threat management in, and keeping those who don't need to be out. Not everything that a kid does or says needs to be in threat management. So as we talk a little bit about the components of an effective system, is you need a statewide system. So we've got that now. A statewide instrument that everybody uses. We've got that now. Training, and this is what the Chancellor talked about. It is a big undertaking, but we embrace it, and the department's embraced it, and the people who are doing it are committed to it, and we're going to get all 20,000 plus of these people trained by January 1, and they're going to be ready to go. A statewide information sharing system. So right now in Florida, and I'll give you some stats on it here in a minute, It's all over the place. You got some districts that have automated systems, some districts that are using pen and paper. The ones that have automated systems, they don't necessarily talk to each other. In fact, they don't talk to each other. You can have the same vendor. One district could have one company, two counties over, that district has the same vendor, and those systems don't talk or share information. So we need a statewide information sharing system. And what you all did in this year's bill was to direct the department to implement a statewide system. You funded it with $7.5 million to procure a system, and then $5 million in recurring revenue to operate it, and it has to be in place by 2025. In the meantime, is that we had a meeting with all the vendors that are out there, and they have to adapt their systems, change their systems to the Florida model by January 1st. And what they've been told by the commissioner is that if they haven't adapted their systems and they aren't ready to go, then their systems aren't going to be used. Because it's not an option. This is going to take effect on January 1st, and we're going to take it to a new level. So it's good, and where it'll really come full circle and we'll maximize it is when the department gets through the procurement process and there's a vendor selected and we have implementation of one system. It's information sharing statewide. So when a kid goes to school in Escambia County and the parents move to Broward County and there's been a threat management convening and the kid is on what we call an SSMP, which is a management plan to help the kid out, is that when the kid leaves Escambia on Friday and the kid shows up on in Broward on Monday, is that they'll have access to all that information. Today, the written records are supposed to transfer within 5 days, but let's be real, okay? So it's, and even within districts, is that there's a challenge in sharing the information. So this is going to be a really significant game changer when this happens. And of course, metric-driven evaluation and accountability. There has to be fidelity in the process, and the way you have fidelity in the process is with accountability measures. This just explains what I basically talked about as far as the new Florida model, the state board rule, and the forms that were approved by the state board. So here are some of the highlights. There's going to be in each school a school-based threat management team that's interdisciplinary, law enforcement, an administrator, a teacher, a mental health professional. And now think about this, and Chancellor touched on this. We have not required in all this threat management process in the last 5.5 years that there be anybody on any one of these school teams that knows the kid. So if the idea is and the concept is and the best practice is, let's identify concerning behaviors. But if you don't know what the baseline of the kid is, because there's nobody on the team that knows the kid, how do you know whether it's a deviation from baseline behavior and whether there's a problem or not? So we're stopping that. Is that it requires that if one of the four core members doesn't know the kid, that they go out into the school and they find a teacher, an administrator that knows the kid, and they serve on the team as an advisor. Because what we're seeing now, again, is too many things are going into threat management and don't belong in there because there's an easy explanation for the behavior and it could be summarily disposed of and we don't have, one, somebody that knows, and today we don't have a summary disposition process. So another thing that is required is that there be a district threat management coordinator. So there's a quarterback in all 67 districts. Each one is required to have a district coordinator to oversee this process and, importantly, review the team's decisions so you have accountability and you have fidelity. The department also has a statewide threat management coordinator that is that coordinator between all the district coordinators and the state, which is a very important aspect and part of this. Under the current system, when people talk about the current system, they talk about the labels and it's a transient threat, it's a substantive threat. It makes your head spin. So why? So the new process, it's real easy. Either it's unfounded, it's low, medium, or high. Easy terminology, easy to understand. It's got some common sense definitions to it. It makes it a lot easier for everybody. We also have a structured case management process with an intake form. Really important. Not everything that is brought to a team's attention needs to go to the full team. So we've implemented with this a summary disposition. You take two kids, 9 years old, they're next door neighbors, they're best friends. They're watching video games last night or playing video games last night, and they get in a fight. They go to school. This happens all the time. One kid says to the other kid, I don't like you. I'm going to kill you. Oh, my God. Put it in threat management. You said the magic words. That doesn't need to go to threat management. Come on. So what we've created here is a situation where we're really overdoing it. And now with a new model is that when that comes forward and somebody brings it, the chair will look at it. First, make a decision whether there's a factual basis. If there's no factual basis, then it's unfounded and we summarily dispose of it. if it's very minor, there may be a factual basis because the kid did say, I don't like you, I'm going to kill you. But they're best friends, they're next door neighbors, they're 9 years old. That doesn't need, so they can dispose of it. So that's a really important part of it. And then implementation of the intake and disposition form to guide and track it, and the new information sharing system. These are some really significant aspects of the new model. Something else that is really important, because it does go to accountability, is timelines and deadlines. Is it under the new, under the current system, somebody brings something to a threat assessment team in Jacksonville, 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, somebody's going to look at it, team might convene. By the time somebody gets around, maybe 2 or 3 weeks, nobody's reviewing it. You take a different district down in Broward, is that it has to be reviewed that day, the principal has to review it. So you've got total inconsistency around Florida about the intake process, timelines, deadlines, review, et cetera. Under the new model, is it has to be reviewed that day. A decision has to be made whether to send it to the team. The team has to convene within 1 day. They have to make a decision within 2 days. They have to get permission for extensions. The principal has to review it and concur or not. The district threat management coordinator has to review it. So there's accountability, and people are overseeing the decisions that are being made. So really important for, again, fidelity of the process. Something under the current model is the current model teaches that in threat management, we don't look at all any allegations of self-harm. When you study this, and you study active assailant attacks and school shootings, is that what you see and what you learn is that absolutely not everybody who has self-harm ideations is going to hurt somebody else. Some of them just need to be in mental health, and we need to put them in that arena, and we need to help them. But what we also know, and the data shows and the studies show, is that self-harm is also a precursor to harm towards others. So it does need to be looked at. It shouldn't be excluded. It should be looked at as today it is excluded from the process. But the data tells us, the history tells us, that that's not right because it is a precursor. So under this, if the situation that's brought forward is totally just self-harm ideation with nothing else, it's going to go directly to mental health. But we're going to evaluate and we're going to look at it. And if it's self-harm ideation, and there's also some ideation towards harm towards others or concerning behaviors that may direct it that way, then we're going to have it on a dual path. We want to get them help immediately, but we also want to make sure they're not going to harm somebody else. So self-harm is not excluded from the new process. And again, we're transforming this from one of threat assessment to management, because you can assess all day long, but unless you're doing something about it, you got nothing. So this creates a student support and management plan, which could be requirements that they do something or prohibitions they don't do certain things. It could be really significant. It could be you put a kid on clear backpacks, they have to be escorted from class to class. It could be, or it could be that they just get help. So they craft a plan, and it allows this management plan and their specific timeline. So if it's a low, they're on an SSMP for 90 days. If it's a medium, they're on a SSMP for 6 months. And if it's a high, then they're on an SSMP for a year. And here's an important aspect of it, is every single month, the threat management team has to meet and they have to review the case. And they can raise or lower the type of monitoring based upon the kid's activity, because if they're doing well, we don't want to keep them on it. If they're not doing so well, we may need to elevate or we may need to adjust it. So they're going to get looked at every single month. I talked to you a little bit about what's going on with the systems around the state. Right now, there's 12 different software systems used by 46 districts. But today, and this is, there's 21 districts that are on pen and paper, including some large districts that are on pen and paper. That's why that statewide system that you all made part of Florida statutes and funded this year is so important, because we need to get everybody on one system, and we need to get these districts off pen and paper. And it's coming, and the department's working hard on it, but it's going to be really a significant game changer for sharing information and managing this. As I said, though, all the existing software systems that are out there, they have to be compliant by January, although it's still going to be siloed until the statewide system, but we're making progress on it. And again, we talked about the training. Oversight and accountability. Department is required by August 1st of each year to evaluate all of the threat management being done by the charters and the traditional public schools, and to publish a report on it. And the rule adopts that. So we can look for a first evaluation of this. It's only going to be for probably about the first 6 months because it takes effect in January. I think the cutoff will be probably May when school lets out, and then the department will publish the first report. I think we'll really get a really significant snapshot in August of 25 because we'll have a full school year to really look at it and know whether we need to do any tweaks or whether it's working well and where we are on it. So that's the rest of this presentation. There's a whole bunch of slides. I'm not going there because we're going to stop so we can take your questions. Is there for your information. It gets into the weeds. It gets into the details of the Florida model. If any of you have questions after you read it, you want more information on it, you're welcome to reach out. I'm happy to, at any time to have any discussion with you about it. But that's the rest of this. I'm not going to go through the rest of it.
Thank you for your presentation, Sheriff. And thanks for including those extra slides, too. I know this was an abbreviated addition to threat management and assessment, and we certainly appreciate it. I'm going to open it up this time to questions. At this time, questions from our members. Representative Cassell. Oh.
Good start there.
I know.
Sheriff, I just want to say, first and foremost, I'd like to recognize our colleague out there in the audience, Representative Hachowski. She was the mayor at Parkland at the time that tragedy took place, and it was at her urging that she suggested that our colleagues go down and visit the scene. I had the opportunity to do that this last Saturday, and you were there. And I've spent 30-plus years as a firefighter, and I've seen, obviously, my share of tragedy. But to walk through Stoneham Douglas and see the scene and have it narrated and see the personal belongings and effects that were left there behind, it's just heart-wrenching. It's left a profound feeling in me, my heart. And I hope that we do, as legislators who make laws, we give you all the resources and all the monies that you need to make this sure this never happens again. And I thank you for your, sir, I know it wasn't easy for you to stand up in front of all those people all day Saturday and explain the situation. So I thank you for your service, sir, and you do have friends up here.
Thank you. Vice Chair Temple.
Thank you. This was a challenging time during, as an educator, and overseeing a school and being there. And I'm thankful for all the hard work that everybody's done to make the impact, to make the necessary changes, because our schools are a lot safer. Are they perfect? No, but we're getting there. And it is a continual movement every day to get better. So thank you for all the hard work. And I'd love to have additional conversations. There's some into the weeds things that I'd love to talk to you about as well. But Senior Chancellor Miller, question for you. With schools running at all different times, you know, you have your traditional school day, but you have after school programs, you have summer programs. How does the mental health aspect of the services that are provided, you know, because mental health isn't on a time clock, it doesn't happen between 8 and 4. And so how do those services support those students outside of the normal school day?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the question. I think there's two answers to that. One is it largely depends on how the district develops their plan. So as I had mentioned, every district has a mental health assistance allocation plan, and they will design their plan and describe how they will kind of identify issues throughout the school day and potentially in extracurricular after-school activities. And then within that plan also, they're going to identify how they will use school-based services and when and how they will make referrals to outside community-based organizations. Because everyone is required to have that contract with outside community-based organizations as well, so that when there are services that they can't provide themselves because they may be too intensive outside their scope of expertise, they make those referrals.
Recognized.
Thank you. So if there's an issue that does overflow, do the
do the same providers, the same people provide the support and services from the school day to the after school typically?
You're recognized.
Again, it would depend on the district and the plan. It certainly could be. It certainly could be, and it could be within the plan how they've got a reporting system within their schools where if something is identified in after school, they know who to report that to so that there can be intervention by a counselor or by a mental health professional within the school who then would assess and determine whether or not it's a school-based service or whether there needs to be referral for to an outside agency.
Yes, sir.
Can I add something onto that? Just
absolutely, and I'm going to ask when you're called upon, please, if you have a series of questions, just have an open conversation. Thank you.
Vice Chair, one of the things I want to just mention is this is still happening today, and you're probably aware of it, and it certainly happened with the shooter at Stoneman Douglas, is the information is still too siloed, and the mental health services are better today and more significant, but you still have a situation where when they're referred to outside services, is the outside providers. So you have school-based providers, you've got private providers, you have community-based. The community-based are largely those that are funded through the managing entities, through DCF, et cetera. And down in Broward, as an example, it's Henderson Behavioral Health is a community-based provider. But you have kids, and this kid was, and you still have kids today, that are on multiple treatment plans, and care coordination is lacking and case management is lacking. Yep. So I think that's important for people to know that, that it happened back in 2018, and these systems, we talk about silos, is the systems that the providers are using, they don't talk to each other. And you have schools that are doing convenings and trying to come up with treatment plans for kids, but the community-based providers aren't going to the school and participating in that, and the school providers aren't going and participating in the treatment plan, so in the staffings that they're doing on that. So I think that's important for people to know, is that there's still work to be done in that area.
Will the plan address that? Will the what we're working towards, is that part of the plan?
I think each district has, each district, the way I understand it, and Senior Chancellor Merrill can probably speak more to that, but some may and some not. I don't see it, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I don't. And part of it is that you got siloed databases. And some of it, I'm just going to be blunt about it, some of it is because of pay points. And so these community-based providers, they don't get a pay point for going to sitting in the school and sitting on the staffing. And so they don't get paid for it. So this is just the nature of it. And it's, you got nonprofits and they're not in the volunteer business. They're in a nonprofit and they got to pay their bills too, but they don't get paid for it. So they can't. So that's another problem with it. And so you got the community base. You also have the kids that are getting services through Medicaid. And that's a whole other challenge in and of itself. So it's very complex when it comes to that. And I mentioned it because it contributed to the Stoneman Douglas, to the Parkland situation, because there was a lot there with this kid, but they weren't talking.
Yeah. One final question. You mentioned the threat management team. Is that going to take the place of the TAT teams? Is that because a lot of the same people, I would imagine, at the school level at least, will be on both of those. So will that
yes.
morph? Okay.
Yeah. So right now, there is a threat assessment team, the TAT team that you're talking mm-hmm. about, and it does have a requirement of the same core four, as we call them, which is law enforcement, mental health, an administrator, and a teacher. But there's no designation of a chair or a vice chair. Now there will be. So that team, we call it the SBTMT as opposed to the TAT team, mm-hmm. so the school-based threat management team yeah. as opposed to the threat assessment team, one and the same.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Gonzalez-Pittman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation. This took an extensive amount of work, and thank you for all your time. I have two questions. When you were talking about the mobile panic alert system, are you all looking to make sure, is there on your matrix or on your rubric, are you checking to make sure that there are a real-time coordination between the first responders? Is that something that you're looking at?
Thank you, Chair.
Absolutely.
So when we do our site visits, this is one of the things that we're looking at. There are a couple different things that we do. One, we will actually go and do testing ourselves where we'll show up at school and say, let's go ahead and test it. And we'll coordinate ahead of time with the PSAP and make sure that it actually works. The other thing is that when we do our site visits, if we're not doing that test, we're reviewing their documentation. Every time a school does an emergency drill, they're required now to do an after-action report, which includes documentation of all the testing that they did of systems. Because when you do an emergency drill, you're required to test all of the systems that you would use in an emergency. It's such as a mobile panic alert system, communications, whatever it may be. And so we're reviewing that documentation to make sure that they documented that they tested it, and if it and it worked, or if it didn't work, what they did to address it.
Okay, so I have a to that a second, and then I have another one. But for instance, what happened at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, where you had two different municipalities, that would be checked on?
No, not by this. No, and that's still a problem. So if you're at Stoneman Douglas High School today and you call 911, your call is going to the 911 center in Coral Springs. Coral Springs does not respond in Parkland. Broward County Sheriff's Office does. They still haven't fixed that problem down there. And you still have two additional, as they call them, PSAPs, which are public safety answering points, which in common terminology is a 911 center, Plantation and Coral Springs, that operate independently from the countywide system. And so you still have a call transfer process. So what happened down there was, is the kids called, Coral Springs answered, they had to transfer it over to the Broward Sheriff's Office, they had to tell their story twice, that same process happens today. They can't work together to fix it.
Okay. Did you have another question?
I do. On the tour, I noticed that this doesn't address the physical plant. Have we addressed with our plan any of the physical, like safe corners, making sure that classrooms have those safe corners?
Yes, and I think that that goes to, and I would put that in the mitigation component. So we talk about prevention, mitigation, response, and recovery. I think that's in mitigation. And it is probably singularly, if, and I mentioned this on Saturday for people who are down there and I talked to, is that if there were a couple of things that would have made a difference at Stoneman Douglas to mitigate, and the safe areas or hard corners are one of them. They didn't have them. Remember, they hadn't done a drill on that campus in over a year. And in that entire building, entire campus, there's only one room with one teacher that made any effort that identified a safe area. And to demonstrate the importance of that or of it is that there are two kids. And Luke Hoyer is one of them. And they couldn't get into that safe area or hard corner because there was immovable objects in it. And it was Helena Ramsey and Luke Hoyer. And as the shooter was shooting through the window, the safe area, the hard corner, would have been where he couldn't shoot because he couldn't see him because they're against that wall, but they couldn't get into it. So they're sitting over here against this wall, and they hid behind a TV set. TV sets don't stop AR-15 rounds. So it showed on the second floor, on the first floor, second floor, third floor, where nobody was shot. None of the kids were shot was on the second floor because he couldn't see anybody. He only shot those that he could see. And so on the second floor, they were all hidden. On the first floor and third floor, they weren't. And that's why he was able to shoot them. So it is a requirement. It's a recommendation from the commission in our reports. It's generally adopted today. Most places have some sort of safe area or hard corner. I wouldn't say that it's universal and total, but we're still working on it. But there's a lot more today than there were before. Some people, and the reason why some people don't do it is, say, I don't like it. I don't like that because you need some sort of a marking in order to identify it. So some people do it as a chalk line on the floor. Some do it across the ceiling. Some just put a dot on the wall. And some people say, I just don't like it at all. And what I say to that, it's not what you like. It's not what you want. It's being real about it, and what can you live with? And I can't live with dead kids. So let's get over and get it done. And so that is still a work in progress. We don't have that universally as much as we should. But it's better than it was.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Chamberlain, you're recognized.
Thank you. Thank you for the information today. A couple quick thoughts and questions. Earlier in the presentation, there was something regarding an audit of a school-based discipline, auditing of school-based discipline. And I'm just curious, in your studies and in as you're working with all of this information to help improve things, have you gone through that study? What are the effectivenesses of how discipline is being taken care of within the school system today? And is that kind of a root cause issue? Meaning, if that were addressed, in your opinion, differently, some of the discipline things that our teachers are allowed to do And that leads into this next part, which is all the same thing. I mean, how much weight and responsibility is put on teachers today to identify these behavioral problems from the baseline behavior that would lead to a lot of the things you were talking about?
So I want to answer part of that and then turn it over to Chancellor Miller. One of the things I want to stress, and again, this is an abbreviated presentation on the overall threat management program, is that threat management and discipline are and have to be totally different and separated. Threat management has nothing to do with discipline. There may be prohibited behaviors that belong in discipline because they are prohibited behaviors. But we have to be careful because we don't want to mix it. Threat management is about identifying those concerning behaviors and getting people help because generally they got something that they're irked about on because of a grievance. And they're beginning down that pathway because they don't know how to cope and how to deal with it. We don't want to mix it because we don't want people to think that if they come forward because they see concerning behaviors or because we are trying to engage them in threat management that they're going to get in trouble, that it's going to be discipline. So we're very careful to make it two different things, really. But it doesn't mean that because they did something that they won't. But as far as the audits and as far as the discipline system, I'll let Chancellor Miller address that. It's more in his area.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Sheriff. Thank you for the question. So I would reiterate, obviously, the separation, and we've been very intentional of that in the training around the state, that these are two separate systems and processes, and we want to make sure that threat management does not become a discipline process. The audit that I had referred to was an audit of school-based diversion programs, and we actually wrote that report with DJJ and submitted it in 2019, and I think the other resource I think that would be helpful is the final report of the 20th statewide grand jury where they look specifically at the Promise program and identified some of the common concerns that they saw in that program and other and a couple of the other diversion programs where I think the one of the terms they used what it was it became bloated and ineffective where there was a good intentions at the beginning but it was not executed well and it became a very ineffective program that led to some real problems.
Thank you. More questions. Mm-hmm. You had mentioned, I believe both of you had, we had been speaking about the differences in the way schools implement things. You know, some of the, trial runs and different. Some schools took it serious, some schools did not. And the school we were talking about maybe didn't do anything for up to a year before that. With what you've presented today, and you may have answered this, but I'd like you to clarify it. Are there some methods by which you would be able to raise that accountability, even in areas where maybe the leadership in that school just doesn't seem to take this item serious the way another school would? How would you raise that bar and help this all be more effective?
I can't, but you can. I'd suggest to every one of you, don't let a bill come out of this body that doesn't have consequences and accountability measures in it. And you saw when Chancellor Miller was going through the progression, is that if you go back and look at it, if you didn't notice, is that what we kept coming back and kept doing was giving enforcement authority, accountability authority to the commissioner and to others. Because when laws are passed, people just need to follow them. But for some reason, they thought they didn't have to, and they weren't. So we kept coming back, and so I'll give you an example. We weren't. So one of the things that Chancellor Miller mentioned was, and this is astonishing, this is really an embarrassment to law enforcement, and is that, again, as I say the same thing to us as I say to anybody else, where you been? 1999. But last year, we did a survey, we looked around. There are police departments and sheriff's offices in the state of Florida that did not have active assailant response policies. I mean, really? So I said, okay, here we go. So went to the speaker and the president and said, look, this was part of this bill. I'd like you to put in here and require by October 1st of 2023 that every police department and sheriff's office in the state of Florida have an active assailant response policy. But I knew, because, I learned, is that you don't stop there. So what we did is, and you all passed it, is said that you have to have one by October 1 of 2023. And by December 1 of 2023, the commissioner of the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, because they have to submit verification they have one to FDLE, And by December 1st, the commissioner has to publish a report and send it to the president, send it to the speaker, and send it to the governor, and out anybody that doesn't have one. So guess what? By October 1st, I know all the sheriffs had them in, because that's what you have to do. This is what, and this is why it doesn't matter. It is same thing with CESR reporting, is that CESR reporting hopefully is better. There's been a lot of changes. It was a mess. So we had to go to the legislature and ask the legislature, so it's in law now, that it makes the superintendent responsible for accurate reporting of these 26 critical incidents that tell you about climate and culture on the campus, because it was a mess. I mean, you couldn't rely on it for anything, I'm telling you. It was bad. And so now with all it is that the Commissioner of Education can order the school district to withhold the superintendent's salary for noncompliance. But that's what we've had to do. And this is where, so, you know, to ensure that we have fidelity and to ensure that things are done, is that I'd encourage you to put accountability measures and consequences in everything that you pass, because if you don't, it's just not going to be 100%. Sorry to say that, but it's real. That's just the reality of it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Yeager, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question was pretty much answered, but I just want to say thank you for that, because that's what I've seen the last couple of years and been kind of shocked by, is the lackadaisical approach to some schools and school safety after this incident. I mean, you mentioned 1999, Columbine, 19 years. I mean, I see schools take a very lackadaisical approach to this, public schools in the last 2 years. So, I mean, we're a couple of years, you know, from it, and we've done that. So I just thank you for that effort, and I think the accountability piece, what you said, is what we, as a legislature, we've got to hold them accountable, because there's little things. I had the opportunity to tour the school as well, and then profound was definitely the word I would use. But and then to see schools, you know, doors open, kids in hallways, just the little things, right? The day-to-day little things that we forget about, and that's just you said culture. That's what I thought about. So thank you for that. We've got to change the culture of the schools so that they do these little things, right? It's just automatic, and they do them and take care of these little things. So thank you for that.
It's not check the box. And it's, for some, that's unfortunately, that's what it is. And this is where we do have to change the culture. And at the end of the day, I don't know, everybody has their own feelings about it. I don't care how people get to where they need to be, if it's because they really, truly believe in it, because it's the right thing to do, and they're getting there for the right reasons, or they're getting there because they don't want to get dinged and they're afraid of the consequences, whatever. You just get there. So, but for some people, that's what it takes.
Thank you. Representative Gant, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question regarding how you said the two agencies don't necessarily have an agreement yet regarding who would respond in a 911 call. So is it possible, and is it a feasible solution for like an MOU to be put in place where when there is an active shooting or some type of situation under this risk management, that could be the procedure for the agencies to proceed by? Like, if Coral Springs does get the 911, but we know that BSO responds, but if it's in that particular situation, that MOU would dictate who responds and support that way?
I mean, they could, and they put a little bit of a Band-Aid on it now. And I think about a year ago that they put a Band-Aid on it, where because before, and it isn't even a compound, it back in 2018. So when the kids at Stoneman Douglas were dialing 911, and the call was going to the Coral Springs 911 center, is that the Coral Springs 911 center not only didn't provide policing, they also had no way to communicate at all with the Broward County Sheriff's Office deputies that were in Parkland, which is right on the line. I mean, literally, the city's adjoined. They're on the line. And there was no way to patch those communications. They had no radio interoperability at all. Today, they've gone to a place where they do have some radio interoperability. And Coral Springs can talk to BSO, but it's still not going to the BSO Communication Center. So they have, through some of those agreements, they've tried to make some progress on it, but they just can't bring it all together and agree on one universal communication center. And I want to say this, that for context, is that that problem of call transfer is not unique to Broward County. That's going on in other places in the state. And so when somebody calls 911, and if you call 911 and they say, 911, what's your emergency? What's your address? And you tell them, and if they're going to, in a lot of places, including in Pinellas, is that they say, hold on, and they transfer your call to the city police department, and you've got to tell your story a second time. So this is, we're making progress on that in Pinellas. We're making, you know, some changes. We're making progress on it, but it's slow. So this is just a problem in different areas around the state, including Broward. It's fixable, but it requires everybody and the stakeholders to come together and want to fix it. A simple MOU is not going to fix it.
Okay. Thank you for that response. That was enlightening. So and I might just not have clarity on the point. Is there a statewide standard that everyone has to abide by?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
The only statewide standard is that 911 calls have to be answered in less than 10 seconds, 90% of the time, but answered. But once they're answered, then they transfer them, and calls get disconnected on transfer. People hang up because who thinks when you call 911, somebody says, oh, hold on a second, let me transfer your call to somebody else and tell your story a second time. But it's happening. It's happening in a lot of places in Florida.
Well, let me clarify. When I say a statewide standard, I mean the threat response standard for schools to adhere to.
Well, from a threat response, that's what I talked about in the presentation.
Yes.
Yes, now, you know, this year is that the legislature passed the statute, the State Board of Education passed it in rule, and this is a mandatory standard for threat management that will take effect on January 1st of 2024. So that is standardized and mandatory, yes.
Okay, so could that procedure for handling 911 calls that come in be implemented in from the DOE or through that process?
No, it's really just two separate things, very different things.
Okay.
Representative Franklin, you're recognized.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. And also thanks to two of you for being on the front lines and your leadership when it comes to school safety here in Florida. My first question is around kind of like a follow-up around the accountability and enforcement and rulemaking piece. I know the last few years there's been a ton of funding, a lot of laws and rulemaking that's happening, and even some rural communities that might have the athletic directors, also your school safety officer, and there's some restrictions on personnel sometimes. My question is around what are some of the challenges have the two of you seen in implementation? And then also from a percentage perspective, you know, when we talk about full compliance with all different laws, regulations, where do you think we are across the state? And then what's like the goal? You know, obviously 100% is of course the goal, but likely how do we actually monitor, understand, and know that our schools are within a certain percentage of our schools are within compliance? And we're talking about also accountability and enforcement. My question is always around, well, what are those challenges? And is there something that the legislature could also do to kind of mitigate those challenges if it's not just being lackadaisical per se?
Chair, thank you. Thank you for the question, Representative. As we have visited schools and have continued to try to support and also hold schools accountable, we've seen, I think, a couple of challenges over the years. One is, I believe, just a lack of consistency. And I think that, as Sheriff Galtieri said, that this new statewide standardized process is really going to make a big, big difference in that we're all playing from the same playbook now. And so when, you know, a district safety specialist walks into a school or we walk into a school, we know exactly what we should be seeing because it's now a standardized process across the state. I think the other thing that's going to make a big difference, one of the challenges, and the sheriff alluded to this earlier or talked about it earlier, is, you know, you've got some districts that are doing paper and pen still, and the ability to share that information across schools, even within a school. You know, if I'm a teacher down the hall, you know, being able to share that information with leadership at the district level to make sure that they're aware of what's happening on the campus. And then, of course, when kids move from school to school or from district to district, that's been a challenge. And this new system that we are procuring at the state level is going to make a big difference in that. With consistency, because the process will actually be built into the system. And so you have to follow the process because the process is built into it, and then as well as with the sharing of information across schools, across districts.
So, and beyond that, just with threat management, it's really hard to quantify percentages too, because there's so many different requirements. And I think you're also talking about things like single points of entry, gates that are staffed, fences with gates that are staffed, safe areas, hard corners, door locks, opaque coverings, and those things. It's better. And I can tell you from experience, I can tell you where the biggest problem is, the greatest void is, the greatest vulnerability is in the charters. The charter schools, not where they need to be. And one of the biggest problems, and I had an opportunity about a month ago to meet with the superintendents, and I asked them, kind of pleading with them, get beyond this angst that the districts have with the charters when it comes to school safety. They need to be responsible. They need to make sure that they are owning it with the charters and help the charters get to where they need to be. The charters are absolutely not where they need to be with threat management. We're going to get them there with this. But the other things with the charters, I'd say if there was the greatest room for improvement, the need is with the charters. I think with the other things that we're talking about, the core things, it took some time and it took a culture change. Y'all said that in March of 2018 that there had to be a safe school officer, a good guy with a gun on every campus, all 4,000 schools in the state of Florida. And when the commission met August 17th, 2019, down in Broward County, first day the commission went was the first day of school, they still didn't have guardians or a good guy with a gun on all the charter school campuses. Now we do, as the chancellor said, but it's taken years. All this, and the door locks, opaque coverings, the safe areas, the communication devices, all those things, it is still a work in progress, but it's exponentially better than what it was. No question about it. And we're moving in the right, but we got to keep our foot on the gas pedal with it. But if I had to say the area that I would be most concerned about is the charter schools.
Thanks so much for the insight. Can I follow up?
I'm going to move on. We only have about 3 minutes left. We have two more representatives that would like to ask questions. So briefly, Vice Chair Temple, I think you had a question.
Very quick. It goes back to Rep. Gant's issue. The electronic notification, does that solve the communications between 911 agencies like the alert systems?
No, two different things.
It doesn't notify the right people when you alert?
I'm sorry. Yeah. So there's some sort, the illicit alert is a work in progress, too.
Okay.
There are some challenges right now with it. And we're better than where we were, but there's some challenges. The department's working through those, diligently working through those and working through it hard. There are some problems right now with making sure that when the alert button is pushed, that it goes to the correct 911 center, or in some cases that it even goes to a 911 center. And they're working through some of those. Okay. There's some, as an example with one of the vendors, is that their product is not geo-based, and you have to manually change it. So if you're at one school in the morning and you go to another school in the afternoon and you push the button here, it's going to think you're over here, and it's going to send the troops to the wrong place. So there are some things like that that are still being worked through. It's a work in progress, but I can tell you, and I want to stress to you, the department is working very hard on this, extremely hard on it, and making sure. But with everything in this area, it's always going to be a work in progress.
Representative Alvarez.
Thank you, ma'am. I'll be quick. Do we just make it so that the sheriffs are the ones that run all the comms and radio centers? And is that your recommendation? And listen, if you say yes, then we run the ball. But to me, I don't understand why it's taking so long for us to get there. I understand the parochialism. You know what we do for a living. But at the end of the day, I don't care because I do not need one more dead body.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't know that that's the answer. It's a slow move to get it done. And wait, some of it has to do also with the 911 funding stream. And there's a lot of money that comes from 911 fees and comes out of here. It's probably something to look at. It's something that's been around. I've talked about it for years. I've talked about it for decades. You can go back and pull some Tampa Bay Times articles from 2007, 2008, where I was talking about this. Is that it is a problem. And I don't know. In some counties, that's the case. They have consolidated communications. There's one. The sheriff runs it. That's it. And you don't have these issues. But you take others that it's all over the place. So I guess the honest answer to your question is I'm not sure exactly that is the fix for it. But we need to keep shining a light on it and getting people to move in a different direction.
Ma'am, sorry. It is what it is. And if we've got to force a hand, I mean, nobody is more pro-law enforcement than us, but we are more pro-children than we are more pro-you. Yep. So if that's the case, then, tell me to do it. Like, tell me the recommendation so that we stop the infighting, so that we stop the mass miscommunication, and we get you where you're supposed to be. That's literally all that matters. The other thing I really want to say is,
Rep. Alvarez, I'm sorry I have to cut you off.
Yep, no problem. I'll talk to you offline.
We're tasked with making sure that we end on time. I want Representative Franklin just to get your question on the record, if you like. You're okay to talk offline too? Okay, I just wanted to give you the opportunity. Thank you so much for being here today. I really appreciate you being here, your use of time, answering all of our questions. To this committee, thank you so much for your active participation. I look forward to more open conversations over this next year. And with that, so that we end on time in 20 seconds, Vice Chair Temple moves to rise without objection, meaning this meeting is adjourned.